Hello and welcome to Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters, and today we'll examine a number of stories and issues in the news. We'll begin with the train wreck in the US Senate, where the Patriot Act expired on Sunday night after a special session called by Majority Leader McConnell failed to get any bill passed amid acrimony as Republican senators walked out on Senator Rand Paul's stand on the Senate floor, which McConnell denounced as a campaign of demagoguery and disinformation, with John McCain remarking later that Rand Paul would be the worst candidate we could put forward for the presidency. Elizabeth Goitein, the co-director of the Liberty and National Security Program at the Brennan Center for Justice, joins us to discuss the next domestic spying bill and her article at CNN, The Battle Over the Patriot Act. Then we'll look into the eye-catching cover of the July issue of Vanity Fair magazine that features a glamorous pose of Caitlyn, formerly Bruce Jenner, with a caption, "Call me Caitlyn." Joe Wanky, a writer, social critic, and LGBT rights activist, and the author of the new book, The Human Agenda, Conversations About Sexual Orientation and Gender Identity, joins us. We will discuss how Caitlyn and the Amazon TV series Transparent are opening up a conversation of acceptance about the transgender community and the transition that Bruce Jenner is undergoing. Then finally, we will get a profile of Senator Lindsey Graham, who announced his run for the presidency on Monday in front of the family restaurant and pool hall in central South Carolina, which he inherited at the age of 22 when both parents died and he was left to bring up his younger sister on his parents' Social Security death benefits. Corey Hutchins, who was twice named South Carolina's Journalist of the Year and has followed the career of Lindsey Graham, joins us. And joining us now is Elizabeth Goitein, who is the co-director of the Liberty and National Security Program at the Brennan Center for Justice, which seeks to advance effective national security policies that respect constitutional values and the rule of law. Previously, she was counsel to Senator Feingold, chairman of the Constitutional Subcommittee of the Senate Judiciary Committee, and her latest article at CNN is The Battle Over the Patriot Act. Welcome to Background Briefing, Elizabeth Goitein.
Thanks very much.
And Elizabeth, I don't understand what Mitch McConnell was doing. Do you? Because at the end of the day, he actually had to endorse the USA Freedom Act, which is the one that he opposed and created this whole mess in the first place.
Right. Well, I don't want to toot my own horn too much, but in November, last November, when he whipped his caucus into opposing USA Freedom Act when there was a vote back in November, I wrote a piece that said that he had made a big mistake, that this was his most painless way out on surveillance reform, and that he had painted himself into a corner that was going to become very uncomfortable for him this spring. And now here we are. And, you know, he is very much in that corner. He was banking on being able to wait until the very last minute and then, through the sheer force of panic, get everybody to vote for a short-term reauthorization of the Patriot Act, and it didn't play out that way. That's just not where the Congress is. It's certainly not where the House is, and as it turns out, it's not where the Senate is either. So he was in a tough spot, and he really had to backpedal. And you know, I think he lost some credibility with this one.
But short of miscalculation, what do you think was driving him? What was his reason for playing hardball after a pretty overwhelming vote in the House on the USA Freedom Act?
I think he was mistaken in his calculus. I think he actually thought that he would succeed in a short-term delay of the Patriot Act, and that during that delay, he would have time to sort of move the focus elsewhere, to the pressure for reform would sort of recede in the interim once the pressure of that deadline was off. There would be time to water down the bill or for another bill to come out. I think he was buying time to take the pressure off and make the bill weaker. And, you know, to some degree, he's certainly still trying to make the bill weaker. So he, Rand Paul, actually managed to buy him some extra time on that because Senator Paul refused to allow an immediate vote on the USA Freedom Bill, which is the NSA reform bill, on Sunday night, because Senator Paul wanted some time to offer amendments. Well, he got the time, but not the amendments. So now all of the amendments that are being offered by McConnell. So these are all amendments that would strip away protections in the USA Freedom Act and weaken the bill. And those votes could happen as soon as tomorrow.
Well, there's certainly a lot of animus towards Senator Paul from the Republican caucus in the Senate. They largely walked out on him, didn't they?
Yeah, I think that animus is misplaced. I mean, this is really not, the situation is not of his making. McConnell knew, we all knew, for 4 years when the Patriot Act provisions were set to expire. There was plenty of time to take care of business before the expiration date rolled around. And as I said before, McConnell was gambling that he could wait to the last minute and then force something through. And that was his mistake. So, he really has no one to blame but himself for the fact that three authorities in the Patriot Act expired at midnight last night. But he's still working to try to prevent a clean reform bill from going through.
But Senator McCain has gone so far as to say that Rand Paul was not fit for the White House. Quoting, I've said it on many occasions that I believe he would be the worst candidate we could put forward. And the fact that they did walk out, and at least much of what I'm reading in terms of press coverage indicates that they're kind of mad at him, the Republicans, that he's kind of the odd man out.
Right. Well, they're not his audience. I mean, they don't vote. They don't decide who the president is going to be. He has a base and he is appealing to that base. It's not quite as craven as it sounds. I think that he believes in these principles, and he is standing up for principles that he believes in. And, a large portion of his base agrees and believes in those principles, too, and they are looking to see him fighting for them, so that's what he's doing. Yes, he has alienated a number of senators, a number of Republican senators. On the other hand, he's raised a lot of money. He's positioned himself in the campaign. And I think he's really, in some ways, done a service by elevating this issue and by forcing the Senate to have a real debate on these issues, which are extremely important.
You mean a real debate and a man standing up for his principles? What's happening here?
Well, it certainly has been fun to watch the Senate in the last couple of weeks because, for a change, we are watching these debates. I'm watching these debates, really having no idea what's going to happen. And there's a real possibility that reform will come out of this process. I think at this point, no matter what else happens, I think it's probably safe to say that the NSA's bulk collection of Americans' phone calls will end. And that is really ushering a new day in the Congress since 9/11. All the legislation that's been passed has gone in the opposite directions, expanding surveillance authorities, sometimes quite dramatically. So this is a shift. And, as an advocate, it's been fun to watch.
And again, I'm speaking with Elizabeth Goitein, who is the co-director of the Liberty and National Security Program at the Brennan Center for Justice, which seeks to advance effective national security policies that respect constitutional values and the rule of law. Previously, she was counsel to Senator Feingold, chairman of the Constitutional Subcommittee of the Senate Judiciary Committee, and her latest article at CNN is The Battle Over the Patriot Act. So behind the scenes then, I'm still having a hard time understanding McConnell, but my understanding is that he's being pushed a little bit by Senator Richard Burr, who's the chairman of the Senate Select Intelligence Committee. And Senator Burr, presumably, if he's not carrying the water for the Intelligence Committee, he's certainly influenced by them.
Well, I mean, in this case, we have the Director of National Intelligence having written a letter supporting the USA Freedom Act and extremely frustrated that McConnell's delay tactics actually resulted in the Patriot Act authorities expiring. So I would not say that Senator Burr is carrying the water for the intelligence community in this case. That's what's so interesting about this is that, you often hear the chairs of the intelligence committees or, other members of the intelligence committees urging the rest of Congress to defer to the judgments of the intelligence community. I mean, these committees are meant to oversee the intelligence community, but more often we hear them saying, we really have to defer to the judgment of our intelligence professionals. Here we have the intelligence professionals saying, we support USA Freedom. That's the legislation that should pass. And then we have the intelligence committee saying, no, really, the intelligence professionals need tools that they're saying they don't need. So it's a new and, I think, uncomfortable position for Senator Burr.
So when the spokesperson for the intelligence community says it's okay, that would probably, a lot of civil libertarians may think, well, what's so good about the USA Freedom Act? It gets rid of bulk collection, but what about these other two parts of the Patriot Act that sunsetted on Sunday night, the lone wolf and the roving wiretaps.
Right. Well, the USA Freedom Act does not address those provisions. It simply extends them. On the other hand, the USA Freedom Act addresses some other provisions, such as national security letters and the pen register and trap and trace authority that are not affected by the three expiring provisions of the Patriot Act. So, these two approaches sort of accomplish different things. I don't think civil libertarians are under any illusions about what USA Freedom doesn't do. It is a compromise bill. It does not go as far as most civil liberties advocates would like. I think many groups are supporting it because they believe that you need to start somewhere, and it's a first step, and that other steps should follow. And I think the administration is probably supporting it because it thinks that maybe if it can get this done, it won't have to do anything else. So I think the motivations are different for support, but there is a fortuitous overlap on that one issue, which is the need to end the bulk collection of Americans' phone records.
So if the White House is basically thinking that this is the best we can get, then what does that say for getting better for those in the civil liberties community that want more reforms?
It says we'll really need to turn the pressure up, and I think there needs to be a process of education, because I think that the American public does not realize, and it's certainly not their fault. I think that the intelligence community has done a good job of obscuring the degree to which some of these other programs that are nominally targeted at foreigners overseas really do sweep in huge amounts of Americans' information, Americans' communications, their emails and their phone calls. And I think that that information needs to really be pushed out there, and we need to try to jumpstart a debate on some of these other programs and other authorities.
Well, one of the things that I keep hearing from critics of the National Security Agency and of bulk metadata and lone wolf and roving wiretaps is that none of these programs have yielded any success, and that the intelligence authorities cannot name one success. Have they named any successes that you are aware of?
Yeah, it's a kind of awkward point for them that they really haven't been able to name any real successes. At the same time that they're out there saying, look, these three authorities, you know, leave aside the bulk collection program. These three authorities are such critical tools, and no, we really haven't seen any evidence of that. In fact, the lone wolf provision, that's one of the three expiring provisions, has never been used. That makes me think it's probably not that critical an authority. The Section 215 authority, which is used for bulk collection but also used for other kinds of collection, is the subject of an Inspector General report, the Justice Department's Inspector General, that was recently released. And that report said that over a three-year period that the Inspector General looked at from 2007 to 2009, there had been no major case developments as a result of records obtained using Section 215. And that leaves roving wiretaps, which I think are used about a few dozen times every year. You know, I think that the roving wiretap authority provides convenience and relieves an administrative burden on the government, because it allows the government to get one wiretap order that covers all the devices that a person might use. But at some point, the government has to figure out what those devices are. And so, in theory, the government could go back separately and get different orders for each device. It's a hassle, but it's not the kind of thing that's going to make the difference between preventing a terrorist attack or not preventing a terrorist attack.
So presumably nobody can cry wolf in these intervening days after these provisions have sunsetted because of the failure to come to an agreement at this special Sunday session of the U.S. Senate. Is anybody making the case that the sky's going to fall in these intervening days, that we're going to be blind?
Sure, everybody. I mean, yes, administration officials right and left are coming out and saying the sky is going to fall. I'm looking outside. I don't see it falling. I think the proof will be in the pudding. I don't think the sky will fall. But I do think, you know, all you know, facetiousness aside, I do think we need comprehensive surveillance reform. It is not enough to say, okay, these three provisions of the Patriot Act have expired. Let's leave them expired. Let's all go home. We really need comprehensive surveillance legislation, comprehensive surveillance reform. USA Freedom is not comprehensive It's a start. It takes on some pieces of it. So there will need to be other bills. There will need to be other legislation addressing some of the other problems and some of the other programs. And we need to get started with that right away and take it very seriously.
Well, given that we missed 9/11, even though there was a lot of evidence out there, we missed the Sadarov brothers, even though the Russians had tipped off the FBI, you know, there are some basic questions about the intelligence community itself and whether or not we're getting our money's worth and we're spending more and more money. And a lot of the critics say this is simply just bureaucratic feathering of the nests and empire building, that you have these vast increasing budgets. But in effect, the analogy that I keep hearing is that the NSA's job is to look for a needle in a haystack, but all they're doing is piling on more hay.
I think that's right. I think there is a bureaucratic imperative to grow. But I also think that there's a cultural or an ideological emphasis on collection, and that makes sense. These are intelligence agencies, and they're focused on data collection. And so it stands to reason that there's a sense that more is always going to be better, and that collecting it all must be better than collecting some of it. I don't think the evidence supports that. It seems to be going the other way. You pointed to some examples where things were missed, and we've had studies of those cases where things were missed, and part of the explanation in each instance has been the government is drowning in data, and real threats are getting lost in the noise. This information still needs to be analyzed. There is no computer program that can identify who the next terrorist will be, and there's not going to be such a program. That's just not how terrorism works, and there's a lot of social science on that. So it still takes people looking at the information, making judgments about the information. You can't do that when you're ingesting billions of pieces of data a day. A targeted approach is going to be more successful, and we need to get back to that.
You mean there's not an algorithm that predicts the future?
You know, there are algorithms that predict a lot of things, and algorithms are good at certain things. They're good at predicting the kinds of behaviors that happen very frequently, that have some very common elements to them. So, you know, credit card purchases, you can look at those and predict pretty well what people are going to buy in the future. But for many, many reasons, terrorism does not fit that mold of an area where algorithms can work successfully. Because terrorist events are so rare, the patterns aren't there to be drawn. And because the different factors that lead people to engage in violence are so disparate and so different, there is no one linear path to terrorism, that also sort of interferes with the predictive abilities of automated analytics. So again, there has been a lot of work on this, a lot of social science, a lot of analysis of predictive analytics in this context. It is not a promising solution to the terrorism problem.
No, but I mean, there are some things you can predict, and one of them that I've heard lately is that with these thousands and thousands of desperate migrants escaping from Syria and through Libya on these boats, many of whom have drowned, that amongst the hundreds of thousands of people that are fleeing, making that dangerous passage across the Mediterranean, that the Islamic State and Al-Qaeda are sprinkling a few people in there. That's a reasonable assumption. Here in the United States, we don't have that kind of a problem. But again, that would seem to be more along the lines of human intelligence as opposed to signals intelligence, which is what the NSA is all about.
There are so many different ways of conducting intelligence. At the Brennan Center, we have a project at the website called Rethinking Intelligence that's sort of interviewing experts and getting a sense of some of the areas where our current approaches to intelligence are on the wrong path or too narrow. Human intelligence is something that needs to be prioritized. And as you're indicating, these sort of geopolitical conditions across the world are things we need to pay more attention to instead of, you know, racing out there with our satellites and our other, you know, fancy digital equipment to try to sweep in communications. That's just not going to be the solution to the underlying problems.
Well, just in closing, back to the politics, which are pretty interesting and pretty dramatic with this special Sunday session of the U.S. Senate that blew up in Majority Leader McConnell's face. He got so mad at Senator Paul that he denounced him from the Senate floor, calling what he was saying a campaign of demagoguery and disinformation. And they're both from the same state, and he's the senior senator and the junior senator. And by the way, McConnell has endorsed Rand Paul for president. So that's a pretty odd statement coming from somebody that has endorsed you.
Yeah, I mean, it was really just a very unusual scenario that was unfolding on the floor, and pretty riveting to watch. I guess that sort of identifies me as the geek that I am. But you know, I was sitting there with my bowl of popcorn watching the whole thing. I mean, it was fascinating.
Well, I thank you for joining us, Elizabeth Goitein.
Thank you very much.
And again, I've been speaking with Elizabeth Goitein, who is the co-director of the Liberty and National Security Program at the Brennan Center for Justice, which seeks to advance effective national security policies that respect constitutional values and the rule of law. Previously, she was counsel to Senator Feingold, chairman of the Constitution Subcommittee of the Senate Judiciary Committee, and her latest article at CNN is The Battle Over the Patriot Act. We're going to take a brief station break. We're back looking into the eye-catching cover of the July issue of Vanity Fair magazine. And joining us now is Joe Wenke, who is a writer, social critic, and LGBT rights activist. He is the founder and publisher of Trans Uber, a publishing company with a focus on promoting LGBTQ rights, free thought, and equality for all people. In addition to the talk show, a novel, Wenke is the author of Free Air, Poems, Papal Bull, and Ex-Catholic Calls Out the Catholic Church, You've Got to Be Kidding, A Radical Satire of the Bible, and Male is America. His latest book just out is The Human Agenda, Conversations About Sexual Orientation and Gender Identity. Welcome to Background Briefing, Joe Wenke.
Well, thanks a lot, Ian. It's great to be back on your show.
And Joe, since you've written about gender identity, I think there's nothing more powerful and graphic than the new cover of Vanity Fair showing Caitlyn, formerly Bruce Jenner. What's your...
Absolutely. I mean, it's really inspiring. We talked a bit about Caitlyn, formerly Bruce, the last time I was on your show. And I made the point then, and it's even more evident now, how brave it is to come out as transgender, and specifically for Caitlyn to come out. There was a lot of presumptuous speculation that this was self-promotion. I think anyone with an open mind and a good heart who saw the Diane Sawyer interview would have been persuaded otherwise. I think it was moving. It was compelling. And the brief video that was released by Vanity Fair today, I think, further reinforces that with Caitlyn saying, you know, I used to have to lie about myself. And I now, you know, I don't have any secrets now. I'm free. And I think that's very inspiring for all of us, really.
And the picture, obviously the photo is done by Annie Leibovitz, who's a famous photographer.
Yes.
But it's a sort of almost like a Playboy cover, isn't it? It's not, you know, that...
Well, it's glamorous, it's beautiful, and I'm sure it's how Caitlyn wanted to be perceived. But for that reason, it's inspiring as well. I think I made the point last time that for all of us, whatever our gender identity, I think the most genuine and authentic thing that we can be is ourselves. But if our true selves, if that's been hidden for many years, revealing that is going to change all of our relationships with our family and our friends and our colleagues. And this is what Caitlyn has faced up to and recognized, that this is really the most important thing to be free and authentic in life. And I also think that it is an opportunity for people who don't understand what it means to be transgender, to learn about that from Caitlin. So again, I think that it is a teachable moment and an inspiring moment for all of us.
Well, just to quote what Caitlin said in this Vanity Fair video that accompanied the front page cover of Caitlin in the issue of Vanity Fair that came out on Monday. "Bruce always had to tell a lie. He was always living that lie. Every day he always had a secret. Caitlin doesn't have any secrets." You know, I guess it's difficult for everybody to understand. I don't understand it, but I did see the Diane Sawyer interview, and I was fascinated by it. And obviously I'm interested. I'm talking to you simply because I find the whole thing so interesting. And to me, it's another example of us as human beings and as a society evolving. So I really salute this person, or now woman, for pushing the envelope. And because apparently a lot of people have been suffering prior to Bruce Jenner's basically introducing people to this phenomenon.
Well, also, I think it shows us that we evolve as human beings throughout our own lives, that our gender identity may evolve throughout life, our sexual orientation may evolve, and that both of those constituents of our human identity are fluid and perhaps exist on a spectrum. And a lot of us hide who we really are because of our circumstances, you know, because of our jobs, because of our social personae, and because of commitments that we already have. All of us have secrets, I would say. It's safe to bet that we all have things that we conceal from other people. So I think one way of relating to this is to think of something that you know about yourself that nobody else knows, and that you're, you know, kind of hesitant to tell, and then magnify that 1,000 times in the case of someone who needs to transition from identifying as a male to identifying as a woman, or vice versa.
So how many people do you think undergo these transitions, whether it's from male to female or female to male? You know, not in the world, but maybe in the United States. Are there any kind of figures?
There have been figures, but they're not very good. I think it's been stated in the past that transgender women are about 1 out of 1,000 people, transgender men about 1 in 10,000. But I strongly suspect, Ian, that there are an awful lot of people who have not come out and who are in the closet. And I also think we need to put this in the context of a progress that we've made on certain LGBT issues like marriage equality. Why has that happened? It's because so many people have come out as gay. And so once you know somebody, you know, son, daughter, brother, sister, friend, colleague, it's harder to objectify somebody who's gay. And it's harder to say, you know, you don't have the right to marry. Now, there are fewer transgender people. This is another reason why it's important for people to come out, people like Caitlin, and for there to be public role models, Laverne Cox, Janet Mock, some of the people in my book, Giselle Alicia. We begin to see that these are human beings just like us, and we begin to then feel maybe they're not so different from us after all. So it's very important for that reason as well.
And again, I'm speaking with Joe Wenke, who's a writer, social critic, and LGBT rights activist. He's the founder and publisher of TransUber, a publishing company with a focus on promoting LGBTQ rights, free thought, and equality for all people. In addition to the talk show and novel, Wenke is the author of Free Air Poems, Papal Bull, an ex-Catholic calls out the Catholic Church, You've Got to Be Kidding, a radical satire of the Bible, and Mailer's America. His latest book just out is The Human Agenda, Conversations about Sexual Orientation and Gender Identity. Another piece of work that is out there in terms of opening people's eyes and minds and hearts too is this series called Transparent. And I've seen a few episodes of it, and first of all, it's brilliantly written and cast. The actors are superb. It's a great piece of work. But again, it really is about introducing to a world and to characters going through these struggles. It's an amazing piece of work and one of the best things I've ever seen on television.
Well, I think, again, it's really important from an educational standpoint for people to begin to see that this is a drama that many people live in their own lives. And, you know, really, when you think about it, We all have issues, as I said before, that we struggle with. Now, I find it a little bit odd but understandable that people don't seem to understand gender identity. To me, it's really obvious. Everybody has a gender identity. There are so many different types of men, so many different types of women. Most people, a very high percentage of people, identify with their biological gender. Some do not. And I think it's as authentic and natural to be transgender as it is to be cisgender, which is the word that we use to describe people who identify with their biological gender. And I think over time, more and more people will come to understand that.
Well, that's what's so wonderful about the TV show. It's I think it's at Amazon, isn't it?
Yes, it is.
Yeah. And Jeffrey Tambor, who plays the father of these three kids, is extraordinary. But, you know, he's a guy that's been, some kind of businessman all of his life, been married, has these kids that are all grown up. He's kept this secret forever. And now that he's sort of retired, he's starts to embark on this new life. It's an amazing portrayal.
He's a great actor. I loved him on Larry Sanders. And it's a story that parallels a bit Caitlyn Jenner's story, because you're seeing someone, let's call it later in life, transitioning from one gender identity to another. And I think as it becomes more and more accepted, this is going to begin happening. We're going to find out that people we know are transitioning in their 50s, their 60s, or in their 70s.
So we'll just all get used to it, right? Is that the...
Yes.
Yeah.
I know, absolutely. You know, and I was having a discussion with someone the other day about marriage equality. It just struck me, 100 years from now, if people look back on a time when everybody wasn't able to get married, gay people couldn't get married, how are we going to look at that? Aren't we going to look at that the way that we look at, well, women didn't have the vote, or that black people couldn't go into restaurants or hotels, look at it like Jim Crow? I think it's going to seem outlandish and preposterous and grossly unfair. And I think that there will come a time, although it will take time, when people will just see it as natural and authentic to be transgender. It will be no big deal. And that's really the point of my book, The Human Agenda. We're all human beings. We all have the same goals.
Well, but it's, you know, do we all want to be the same? Are we going to be, all homogenized? Isn't life more interesting when you have variety?
I think that that's the ultimate litmus test. How do you respond to people who are different from you? If you embrace and celebrate, I think that reveals something about your character. If you see someone who's different as the other and demonize, I think that reveals something about your character as well.
So that's our challenge then as a nation? Is that your feeling?
I think it is really to embrace diversity, to celebrate it. And I think that's ultimately what equality is all about. And I just, for life of me, can't understand people who want everybody to be exactly like them. I mean, that life would be incredibly boring if that were the case, if we were all clones of one another.
You mean if we're all like Sarah Palin?
Or pick anybody. Why would we all want to be alike?
Well, but she's a real American, that's why.
Yes, but I mean, that's what really, to me, is one of the great adventures of life, meeting new people and opening up to new ideas and new experiences.
So back to the cover of Vanity Fair with Call Me Caitlin, a picture of Caitlin, formerly Bruce mm-hmm. Jenner. What's your sense of how this is going to, it's obviously got my attention. I think it's got a lot of people's attention. I mean, I can't...
Well, it definitely has gotten a lot of people's attention, and I think it's going to be educational. I think it's going to be eye-opening. We know that there is going to be a reality TV show, but Caitlin makes it clear that this is not simply about self-promotion. It's really part of her life's journey. And we've learned that a lot of people share their life's journeys on reality TV these days, and so this is another example of that, but it doesn't make it less authentic.
Well, it sounds like it's going to be a little bit like the TV series that we were talking about.
Exactly.
You know, that this is on E! Entertainment, and
right.
It's apparently 8 one-hour episodes, and according to a statement from E! Entertainment, it will cover Ms. Jenner's life as a transgender woman and also explore what Bruce's transition means for the people in his life and how those relationships are affected, while offering a better understanding of the challenges those in the transgender community often face. So I'm ready to watch it. I must say I don't like reality TV, and least of all the Kardashians. So I'd say this is a step up from the Kardashians.
I'm not a fan either, but I'm going to make an exception in this case.
Well, Joe, how's your book doing?
It's doing great, and I'm running all around, having really interesting panel discussions. One Wednesday night in New Jersey, and then I'm flying out to San Francisco. It's sort of like bringing the book to life. Giselle Alesi and Why I Love are with me in New Jersey, and Hita Valoria, who's an intersex activist, Kevin Fisher Paulson, who has an amazing story to tell about how he and his partner Brian initially saved the lives, really, of three foster kids and then lost them to the foster system, but then adopted two boys. And he's going to join Giselle and me for a panel discussion out there. So, you know, it's a book, but it's really sort of a launching pad for more discussion, and that's sort of what I've been up to lately.
Well, this couldn't be more appropriate than what's Absolutely. Happening now with the cover of Vanity Fair. I think you started the conversation, but I think this Vanity Fair article is going to propel it a little further.
And I think it's going to open us up to discuss more and more issues. It's great that we're making strides with marriage equality, but there's so much left to accomplish. It's still dangerous for transgender women, particularly, to walk the streets. There's a lot of prejudice, a lot of misunderstanding, a lot of resistance to LGBT people forming families, adopting children. And I think it's really a matter of educating people and letting everyone know that we're all just human beings, as I said before, with the same goals, the same dreams, and the same aspirations.
Well, I thank you very much for joining us here today, Joe Wanky.
Thank you so much, Ian. You have a great day.
You too. And again, I've been speaking with Joe Wanky, who's a writer, social critic, and LGBT. He is the founder and publisher of TransUber, a publishing company with a focus on promoting LGBTQ rights, free thought, and equality for all people. In addition to the talk show, a novel, Wanky is the author of Free Air, Poems, Papal Bull, and Ex-Catholic Calls Out the Catholic Church, You Gotta Be Kidding, A Radical Satire of the Bible, and Male is America. His latest book just out is The Human Agenda, Conversations About Sexual Orientation and Gender Identity. We're going to take a brief station break. We'll be back with a profile of Senator Lindsey Graham, who announced his run for the presidency on Monday. Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing. And joining us now is Corey Hutchins, who was twice named South Carolina's Journalist of the Year by the State Press Association and covered politics for the Free Times in Columbia and the City Paper in Charleston before moving to Colorado, where he writes for Columbia Journalism Review's United States Project and the Center for Public Integrity. He's also the author of The Accidental Candidate, a 2012 graphic novel about the bizarre U.S. Senate campaign of Alvin Green in South Carolina. Welcome to Background Briefing, Corey Hutchins.
Hey, how are you?
Good, thanks, Corey. And Lindsey Graham, no surprise, announced on Monday in his hometown of Central South Carolina, in front of his family restaurant and pool hall, that he's running for president. And so let's start with Central South Carolina and the family. I mean, what I found interesting about Lindsey Graham, the person, is his story, a life story, where he lost his mother when he was 21, his father when he was 22, and essentially brought up his sister as a father and took over the family business and, of course, has basically said, you know, this is a great country because I can start out in a pool hall in the middle of South Carolina and end up in the United States Senate.
That is a great personal historical story that Lindsey Graham loves to tell on the campaign trail. I've heard him say that, you know, from the stage when he's running for election. Always a big hit, especially I think among people who don't know that about Lindsey Graham. Lindsey Graham really in South Carolina is kind of, you know, this known as like this real Washington creature. I don't think there's any U.S. senator who is in front of national TV cameras more than Lindsey Graham. And there's always this joke that you can turn on any cable morning show on Sunday and find him talking about the issue of the day. And so when he gets out there and tells this story about growing up in a pool hall, and what he likes to say is that everything he learned about politics, he learned growing up in a bar and a pool hall, and it's always the last line when he does it. In contrast that with someone he's running against, Marco Rubio, who tells a similar story, but it's about his father. Marco Rubio says that, you know, nowhere else in the world could I be standing in front of this podium speaking to you when my father worked for years behind a bar so I could be here doing this. Well, Lindsey Graham, you know, could say something similar, and yet I think there's just something really interesting and really personal about that story, and it sounds really good with a Southern accent, too.
Well, you covered his 2014 re-election, where he was up against three Tea Party challengers in a state where Trey Gowdy won a seat as a Tea Party candidate, and Nikki Haley, the governor, won a seat as a Tea Party candidate. She's now the governor. So he was up against a lot of pressure, but I guess he was blessed by the fact that he was running against three wingnuts, right?
Six people he was running against.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, and that did help him because it certainly splintered the vote across all those six people, and he did not have to get into a runoff in South Carolina. He won the primary outright. I covered that campaign for the Free Times and the Charleston City Paper in Columbia, and that was like, back then, that was like the huge question about South Carolina. South Carolina is when it comes to Republican politics, it's an incredibly volatile and very unpredictable state. And it's getting even more so. It used to be that in South Carolina, if you're running for president, no matter what happens in Iowa, no matter what happens in New Hampshire, if you win South Carolina, you're probably going to get the nomination. And in fact, for something like ever since Ronald Reagan in 1980, whoever won the South Carolina Republican primary in the presidential election would go on to become the nominee. And so you had to do it. It was the firewall. That stopped in 2012 when, you know, a lot of folks thought Mitt Romney was going to take it, and South Carolinians bucked tradition for the first time in 30 years and voted for Newt Gingrich, who, as we know, did not last very long after that. And so a real good question this year is about how, how important South Carolina is, and what complicates that even more is that Lindsey Graham is a native son in South Carolina. I don't think, though, that anybody in South Carolina who follows this stuff just expects that he's going to win because he's from there. What it might do is, you know, it's really going to scramble the calculus for the other candidate. Do they want to come down to South Carolina and play in Lindsey Graham's backyard when he's running for president? That's going to make, I think, the South Carolina primary like a lot more interesting this year.
Well, it does seem that Rand Paul's new PAC, I don't know whether you've seen the extraordinary ad that they put out, Rand Paul as a one of those WWW wrestling style ads where Rand Paul's got this huge muscular body, and then they cut to Lindsey Graham in a tiny little sort of girly pink convertible. I mean, it's pretty clear as an insult. So How has he dealt with the fact that he's a sort of, you know, a bachelor? And obviously there's that, you know, that rumor is out there.
As I said, I don't recall it coming up in the last campaign that he's had to address anything like that. He certainly has answered that question in the past. I believe it was in a 2010 article in New York Magazine where a reporter asked him straight up, and he said that that wasn't true. And that was the same magazine profile. And this is in July, like the summer of 2010. It's the height of the Tea Party movement all across the country and in South Carolina. And Lindsey Graham's riding around in a car in like upstate South Carolina with this magazine writer from New York Magazine is profiling him. And when the article came out, it really surprised me a lot, because the whole time Lindsey Graham is talking about how he's kind of trashing the Tea Party movement. He's saying, oh, you know, this movement's not sustainable. And what was interesting about that is it tells you a lot of how personally confident Lindsey Graham is with his politics. This is a guy who's going to, he kind of has, like, one of his best friends is John McCain in the Senate. And they always call, you know, John McCain a straight talker, right? He ran the Straight Talk Express. I think Lindsey Graham is like renting the Straight Talk Express from John McCain during this campaign. I think that he's not going to be one of these politicians that is going to shy away from tough questions. And I think that's why he's in the race. I think he's in the race, number one, because he's a war hawk. And he doesn't see enough war hawking going on out there in the Republican field. He certainly doesn't see it from Rand Paul. And I think his best opportunities are going to be in the debates, where he can really talk about, you know, why we need more national security, why we don't need to be cutting military spending, why we need to go bomb here or bomb there, why, you know, we need more drones out there, not less, things like that. I think that's why he's in the race. And as I said, I think one of the, anybody interested in who Lindsey Graham is should try and go find that New York Magazine profile from 2010.
Well, John McCain's already said that he's going to wipe the floor with these other candidates on national security. And, of course, John McCain and I think probably Lindsey Graham also, they all walked out on Rand Paul on Sunday night in the Senate, a clear rebuke. And Senator McCain has basically said that Rand Paul is not fit to become president and is using the United States Senate as a sort of fundraising platform. So they're not real happy with him. And that's what's interesting about him, is that he's combative, isn't he, Lindsey Graham?
He is. And this thing with Rand Paul is funny also, because he had the same antagonistic relationship with Rand Paul's father, Ron Paul. I think it was in 2008 when Lindsey Graham was mercilessly booed at a Republican Party convention in South Carolina when he made some dismissive comment about Ron Paul and said something like, I'm not going to let Ron Paul take over this party. And people just started booing him. And, you know, he just looked right back at this booing crowd and pointed at this one guy and said, you know, listen, I'm a winner, pal, and if you don't like it, there's the exit sign. So, you know, when he says things like that, he means it. He believes he is in this race to win and become the Republican nominee for president.
So you don't think he's in there as McCain's surrogate to take on Hillary Clinton on national security, in the way that, say, Carly Fiorina is in there as a female surrogate?
You know, he did mention in his speech, I watched his speech today in his hometown in Central South Carolina, and he said something about how he always has this line about, like, I've been right more than I've been wrong when it comes to national security. He said, you know, I know more about national security than anyone else running, or something like that, and then he called out Hillary Clinton by name. He paused and said, even you, Hillary, and that was, like, a big applause line at his speech today.
And Corey, in terms of him going against the grain as a Republican, he also supports Social Security, doesn't he? Not because he lived on his parents' Social Security. His mother died when he was 21. His father died when he was 22. And he brought up his sister on the parents' Social Security death benefits.
Yeah, he does make it a point to talk about supporting government when it works. And he does use his personal biography to bolster those points. I do think, you know, we might have to check this, but I think if we go back and look at something he said in his speech today, while he did bring up those points, he said that, you know, we do need to take a hard look at entitlements in this country because they are, you know, unsustainable. Lindsey Graham's a pretty good politician when it comes to talking, so... you know, he's going to say what he means, but, you know, he'll do it in a way, I think that, you know, what he thinks will resonate with Republicans.
So in terms of beating these six candidates that he was up against and in a state that had turned Tea Party with Trey Gowdy and who's now heading up the Benghazi inquiry, and also with Tea Party Governor Nikki Haley, obviously, the fact that this West Main Street Values Pact raised around $900,000 for Lindsey Graham's 2014 re-election campaign, according to USA Today, along with about $275,000 worth of advertising. So, to some extent, I guess the Tea Party is a little bit right when they say he's a Washington guy, because he's certainly got some serious money behind him.
Yeah, although he's an establishment Republican, for sure. He is your Chamber of Commerce, kind of a more moderate mainstream Republican, absolutely. And he really has no problem saying that. You know, when his opponents would attack him for working across the, you know, for reaching across the aisle, he told them, you know, that's how government works. When his opponents would say that they didn't want to vote for him because he helped nominate Obama's Supreme Court justices, his answer would be, look, elections have consequences. They were qualified. He's not, again, you know, he's just not one of these politicians that kind of, you know, hedges what they say, or, you know, he'll tell you what he thinks, and he really doesn't shy away from his policy positions. I think he's at his best when he's debating why he did something.
Well, on the other hand, though, he does occasionally throw red meat to the right, doesn't he? Because he told a Senate panel that he owned an AR-15, that's the civilian version of the M16 assault rifle, because he'd need one if society collapsed and gangs started marauding, and he also introduced a proposal to ban abortions after 20 weeks. So,
yeah, and that was during an election season. That's right. He knows when to come out with that stuff.
Right. So you've spent time with him. What do you think of him? I mean, it seems like with so many people in this race, it's all seems to be getting more and more of a joke. And Fox News has now said that we're going to winnow it down to 10. 9 are in now. I think it's another 6 about to announce at least. Do you think he's going to get winnowed out, or will he be in the top 10 at least?
I don't know. If it's based on poll numbers, I think he's obviously going to have to. It's a tough call because, as I said before, you know, his name recognition should be pretty high nationally because he's on all these talk shows all the time. He knows how to raise money, and I think it would be a shame if he wasn't in these debates, because I think Lindsey Graham is really going to be what makes these debates really, really interesting and really, I think, be helpful to hash out some of the real issues that the Republican Party is facing, that, you know, answer some of these questions that the Republicans across the country have. I think you lose that if Lindsey Graham's not there, and I think that would be a really big hit to his campaign, because I think that's where he believes that he'll probably, do the best to get his message out there. When he's confronting these other candidates on a debate stage, and it's particularly about national security.
Right. Well, that's what McCain has said, and that's what he hopes for. But I was just curious, with this, the fact that Fox has already, and they're going to do the first debate, said they're going to limit it to 10 based on poll numbers. They don't have a lot of time to get their poll numbers up, do they?
Right. And of that 10, I'm not even sure if Lindsey Graham's been that 10 yet.
Right. Well, yeah, that came out.
As somebody who covered him and as someone who lived in South Carolina for a dozen years, if I'm watching a Republican debate, I hope he's there. I just want to hear what he has to say.
Well, but you said he's going to, no matter what, he's going to play an important role in South Carolina, which is a key primary state after Iowa and New Hampshire.
And that is a really big question, because what if he doesn't do well in Iowa? He's actually also pinning a lot of his hopes on New Hampshire. John McCain was there, and Lindsey Graham's been spending a lot of time in New Hampshire, and he's sounded like, from the press covers that I read, he's really enjoying himself at these kind of town hall styles where people can ask him anything. It's not just South Carolina. He's probably definitely looking at doing well in New Hampshire, maybe a little less so in a state like Iowa. But say, he doesn't do well in Iowa, of course. He doesn't do well in New Hampshire, and then it comes down to South Carolina. A big question is going to be whether he's going to actually make it all the way through to the election, or whether he does something like, understands that the campaign's not going as well as he'd hoped, and he pulls out within a few days of the election and throws his support to somebody like Jeb Bush, and all of a sudden he becomes a kingmaker. And somebody like Jeb Bush possibly wins and then maybe makes him Secretary of State. Who knows? So the question is, really, the two questions are, one, is he going to do well in South Carolina if he sticks it out? Or two, will he just be there to kind of open the door for somebody else if he ends up wanting to support?
Well, Corey Hutchins, I thank you very much for joining us and for giving us a portrait of the candidate from South Carolina.
Always great to talk to you. Thank you.
And again, I've been speaking with Corey Hutchins, who was twice named South Carolina's Journalist of the Year by the State Press Association and covered politics for the Free Times in Columbia and the City Paper in Charleston before moving to Colorado, where he writes for Columbia Journalism Review's United States Project and the Center for Public Integrity. He's also the author of The Accidental Candidate, a 2012 graphic novel about the bizarre U.S. Senate campaign of Alvin Green in South Carolina. This has been Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters. I'd like to thank producer Graham Fitzgibbon. This program is available for podcasting at ianmasters.com, where you can scroll down on the right-hand side to subscribe to iTunes podcasts. And I'll be back again tomorrow with another Background Briefing. Bye for now. The headline.